Thursday Arts Preview receives support from Boo Radley's, Toys, Books, and Gifts for the Quirky Minded, and Atticus, the coffee shop and gift store for the grown-up lurking within, both on Howard, across from the Carousel, in downtown Spokane.
Welcome to the Thursday Arts Preview, where the P is parenthetical. I'm your host, EJ Iannelli. Depending on your generation, Dave Garraway might be the most famous man you've never heard of. Spokane Public Radio's very own Brandon Hollingsworth has co-written a biography of Garraway, and we'll speak with him about the man that the subtitle describes as television's original master communicator a bit later in the program. And that's not the only literary-related story we have this week. As it turns out, Whitworth University is getting into the publishing business. With a little support from Washington State University Press, the North Spokane College is creating Pines Press. The project was conceived by two individuals, one at each university. Our Morning Edition host Doug Nadvornik recently spoke with Amanda Clark and Linda Bathgate about the new publishing partnership.
The two protagonists in this story are Amanda Clark, the Dean of Whitworth's Library and Special Programs, and Linda Bathgate, the Assistant Director and Editor-in-Chief of WSU Press. Clark says their relationship began just before the start of the COVID pandemic.
I came down in January of 2020, I think, and met you, Linda. It was the last things we did that year, as I recall. So I came down and did a presentation on SAH Archipedia, which is an online open source encyclopedia of architecture. Met Linda, we got to talking. And then very shortly after that, Linda came up to Spokane and gave a workshop here at Whitworth for professors to learn how to publish.
Bathgate says they went out for dinner and conceived of Pines Press.
I kind of broached that question of, you know, would that be something that Whitworth might be interested in pursuing? And you jumped on it, yes.
But COVID intervened, and the idea was put on hold.
How did lockdown affect this project?
I would say it slowed it down in that, you know, we didn't know how long lockdown was going to take. You know, when we first left the office, we thought this is going to be a couple weeks. And so, you know, just kind of like figuring out what we needed to do. But ultimately, once we realized that we were in it for the long haul, I think then Amanda and I want to say we probably had some email exchanges and kind of just followed up with that, because once Amanda expressed interest and was exploring the logistics on her end, I needed to work with her on a proposal that would then be approved by my administration at WSU that would say, you know, we want to work with Whitworth University on this endeavor.
But as with many things in the world during the pandemic, the Pines Press idea fell down the priority list. Until one day, as the COVID threat was waning, Amanda Clark got in her car and drove to Pullman.
I was so enthusiastic about WSU Press because they, just to sing your praises a little bit, they do such beautiful jobs with the physical book, where many publishers have moved away from, I think, really enjoying that end product experience. And the pairing with WSU was perfect. It's close regionally. And then I feel like Linda and I had a shared, you know, meeting of minds around publishing. So that we just hit it off.
So Linda, what's in it for WSU?
There's a couple of things. Part of it is it supports our mission in terms of serving the community and providing another channel of publication for Whitworth scholars who might otherwise not want to publish elsewhere or not be able to publish elsewhere. It certainly benefits them. And for us, it gives us really more content to produce and sell.
And after all, if you don't have books to sell, you don't make any money.
So it's a way for us to expand our publishing program. And then Whitworth will do a lot of promotion then to its own alums and its own contacts. And that's a community that we don't reach.
Amanda Clark says Pines Press will initially focus on the Whitworth academic community.
I served on our Faculty Research and Development Committee here at Whitworth. And during that 3-year time, I came to realize that a lot of our faculty, for a variety of reasons, would do research or begin a manuscript. It would be writing, but it would never come to publication. They would never see the project all the way through, which is why Linda first came to do that seminar on campus. You too can publish. Don't give up, because it's kind of a brutal industry in higher ed. You can get a manuscript that you've spent, you know, years writing and researching, and it won't pass peer review, or you'll run out of energy, or
your time gets eaten up by other things, by service in your department, promotion and tenure concerns.
Yeah. So I thought, well, I bet there are faculty all over campus with dusty manuscripts in bottom drawers of their desk that never saw the light of day. And I want to give them a platform, both here and at other schools, of course, a platform to seek out a real publication, you know, success. So that's part of what's behind this.
Their subject areas are going to be distinctly different from what we publish at WSU Press. Whitworth, having a religious affiliation, will be watching out for anything that might be, you know, proselytizing or anything along that line, because we want to keep it on the academic as much as we can, an academic footing. We definitely don't see it as that we'd be competing at all.
That's Linda Bathgate from WSU Press. Amanda Clark from Whitworth sees Pines Press as a place where once hot academic lines of inquiry can be revived.
As I'm starting to receive manuscript proposals, I can see that story being told. The presses are saying my research is too focused, it's too specialized, there isn't a big enough market to make it profitable. And so that's something I'm interested in, because I'm not looking for huge bestsellers, right? Big market value and appeal. But is this really important scholarship that needs to be seen by other scholars?
Does WSU have similar arrangements with other universities or other smaller presses?
No, this is our first one. I came to the press in 2019, and my plan at that point was to reach out to Western Washington, you know, the other state universities,
right,
as well as the more of the smaller universities that might want to have a publishing list that they could control, but didn't have the facility to actually start up a press.
And so having Pines Press, which for Whitworth faculty will give them that pride of university, is that incentive enough for them to dust off those dusty manuscripts and finish them, knowing that, hey, it's my university, will publish my book?
We hope so. I'll speak to the faculty next month. So really, our launch is just now happening. We hired an intern last month. She's got an Instagram started. And so we have an Instagram account. We have 3 posts so far on that Instagram account. So this is just now happening. It's live as we speak, right? That this is just happening.
Okay, well, and so, one of the most important aspects, once we had a name, was to have a colophon or a logo for the press. So Amanda was working with people on her end to get an idea, because that's part of the identity of the press, is kind of what their logo looks like.
The Pines Press logo, as you would guess, is a rendering of a pine cone.
Also evokes the vision of pages flipping open in a book. And so if you go to our Instagram or to the little makeshift website that I've created, you can see that. And it's really fun. And they also focused, of course, on, will it look good on at a small scale on a book spine? Will it look good larger, the internet? So yeah, that's been fun.
So does it add to Whitworth's prestige to have its own printing press?
Sure. And as Linda was saying, we had to go through that process of creating an MOU between the two institutions, and there was lots of paperwork involved. And I was very fortunate that the second in charge, I guess you'd say, of the university, was very enthusiastic about this project. And he's taking a report to the board meeting this April to share with our board of directors.
Amanda Clark from Whitworth says it's possible the first books with Pines Press on the spine could be released by early next year. We also heard from Linda Bathgate from WSU Press, Whitworth's partner in this project. I'm Doug Nadvornik reporting.
Spokane Public Radio's Doug Nadvornik speaking there with Amanda Clark and Linda Bathgate about Pines Press, a joint publishing initiative between Whitworth University and Washington State University Press. For more information on the new imprint, head to libguides.whitworth.edu/Pines Press. Publishers like Pines Press need authors, and thankfully, there's no shortage of ideas and information that deserve wider knowledge. Incredibly influential public figures that were household names just a few decades ago have since been relegated to footnotes, even though their stories could fill volumes. According to Spokane Public Radio's All Things Considered host Brandon Hollingsworth, that's true of Dave Garraway, a pioneering TV and radio personality. In an effort to reintroduce Garraway and his legacy to a wider audience, Hollingsworth has co-written a book with the scholar Jody Peeler titled Peace, The Wide, Wide World of Dave Garraway, Television's Original Master Communicator. This week I sat down with Brandon to talk about the book and began with the obvious question, who was Dave Garraway?
It is interesting, EJ, that we even have to ask that question today because in his era, the 1950s and 60s particularly, it was hard to not know who Dave Garraway was. We have celebrities that have tremendous public knowledge today, Taylor Swift is an example, the British royal family, for various reasons. Dave Garraway had a tremendous cultural saturation in this country from the end of World War II to the early 1960s, and today is virtually forgotten. But when I tell you and tell our audience, he was the guy that helped start the Today Show, right? We all know what that is. He hosted many programs for NBC. He was a radio impresario. He was a tastemaker for jazz. He helped popularize the careers of Harry Belafonte and Sarah Vaughan and Earl Fava Hines. He was a champion for civil rights. He was in magazine advertisements. He emceed things all over the place. He had a cultural saturation. He was easily one of the most popular people in America, most well-known people in America, and yet, after he left television, his fame really evaporated very quickly. So it's kind of funny to come back to it now and say, here's the most famous man you've never heard of, but he kind of is.
Yeah, and when you say cultural saturation, I mean, the extent of this, where he was appearing weekdays on the Today Show, and then you would be able to catch him on Fridays, and then you would be able to catch him on Sundays. The sheer ubiquity of Dave Garraway was something that really stunned me when I was reading Peace.
Yeah, and we don't see it these days from many television or even movie personalities. We tend to segment people into their careers, right? So Robert Downey Jr. is really famous, but it's for doing movies. But Dave Garraway, as you pointed out, was in multiple media simultaneously. You might open a Life magazine, and there he is selling, you know, insulation or carpeting to you. You know, he was that famous that he was highly sought after as a commercial pitch man, as an MC. He would guest host other people's TV shows. In fact, guesting on newspaper columns, back when newspaper columnists would take a week off in the summer, Dave Garraway would have a ghostwritten column that would run in their place. So, you know, just had that kind of fame.
And so we've established now Dave Garraway's cultural import. But I want to talk about the man. This was someone who was a very curious child, and that was something, that childlike curiosity was something that persisted throughout his life. He was a bit of a tinkerer. And there was also something, I think he questioned the status quo and why things were a certain way. So we begin to see aspects of the personality who was Dave Garraway, but I'll lean on you to paint a fuller picture.
Yeah, off camera, away from the microphone, yes, he was a very curious man. He reminds me a little bit of something that Bill Moyers said about Lyndon Johnson. And Moyers said, Lyndon Johnson was 13 of the most interesting and complex men I ever met. I think if he ever worked with Dave Garraway, he would have come in a close second. He loved to work on his cars on the weekends and in the evenings. He would take radios apart to see how they worked, not just in childhood. He collected telescopes. Around people, he could be a little difficult. Many of the people who knew him as friends and who worked with him as colleagues at NBC have pointed out over the years that he could be relaxed and gregarious and casual and interesting on television, but could be very prickly off the air. His moods would shift dramatically. He struggled with depression for a lot of his life after World War II and through the remainder of his life. He had a drug dependency that had a lot to do with, of course, the early morning hours and the hours that he kept on today. He took a lot of Dexedrine, which was a powerful amphetamine, and vitamin E and other things like that to help him maintain his energy level, which took their own physical and mental toll over the years.
And this was called the doctor. He referred to it quite euphemistically as the doctor. And it was something that began shortly after, I think, his service in World War II, no?
Yeah, he started in radio in Honolulu when he was stationed there with the Navy. He was initially assigned to a destroyer in the 1940s, found out he got violently seasick, so that was the end of that, but he was still in the Navy. The war was still going on. They said, what can we do with this guy? They assigned him to the Yeoman School at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, and in the evenings, he didn't have anything to do, and so he walked into the NBC radio affiliate, KGU, and said, you need anybody? And they said, yeah, from, 10 to midnight, if you've got some time, do I ever? And again, he's keeping late hours and has a day job. That stayed with him when he came back to the United States. He worked for WMAQ in Chicago, the NBC affiliate there, hosting a midnight jazz program called the 1160 Club. And again, keeping those hours plus doing personal appearances as his fame grew, but you still have a midnight to 2 a.m. show, your hours get pretty thin. So he concocted this elixir that he called the doctor, and he sipped on that all through his years on the Today Show through the 1950s and really did not kick the amphetamine habit until the late 1970s.
And it took Dave Garraway a lot of work to cultivate that Dave Garraway persona that the public then saw.
Yeah, he told an interviewer about that, too. His first stint in television came in the late 1940s in Chicago, when he was already doing the radio show at WMAQ. MAQ was also a television affiliate for NBC, the fledgling NBC television network. And he got a show called Garraway at Large, and he mentioned that to an interviewer. He's like, what you see when I'm just kind of walking around and observing and pontificating and introducing the segments takes a lot of work and a lot of prep. People used to say the difference between Dave on rehearsal day and Dave on show taping day was he wears shoes on show taping day, but there was a lot more to it than that. He cultivated this image that really not just appealed to people, as you said, on television, but even fooled some of the people he worked with.
But his very curious nature and his sponge-like curiosity, where he just wanted to know about everything, that served him very well in both careers, because it was that quality that people actually... He was a little polarizing, wasn't he? You could either love him or hate him, and there were people who fell into both camps.
Throughout his entire career, yeah, starting at WMAQ in Chicago. Now, I would say that the preponderance of evidence is that it was more love than hate. People generally thought he was very popular. He was thought of as a very important person for NBC and for WMAQ. His paychecks reflected that because he was making crazy money in the late 1940s and 50s.
I wrote down a sum. He was making $10,000 a week in 1951. Mm-hmm. $10,000
a week
in 1951.
Times 52 weeks a year and adjust that to 2024 dollars. I can't do the math on that, but it's a lot of money. I would say this too, that when he was in the middle of his tenure on the Today Show, he re-upped a contract with NBC in March of 1956 that bumped him to $260,000 a year then, and I did do the math on this one, it's more than $3 million a year today.
Wow.
So you get the idea. This man was valuable. He had the ability to connect to the audience. He had that ability to kind of do a little bit of everything. You mentioned know something, talk about something, great interviewer, good listener, and those qualities were so brilliantly valued at that time that led to that.
So with all that in mind and with all that context, let's talk about what might be seen as his lasting legacy or his enduring legacy, which is the Today Show.
Yeah, because the Today Show's still on today. In fact, we're sitting here in 2024. It still airs, 7 days a week on NBC. And even though our media landscape has changed dramatically, it's not the dominant program that it once was. It was the first. And not just the first in the sense of being the answer to a trivia question, but the first in the sense that nobody else was doing it. So if you wanted to watch something on television in the morning, it was it. There was no Good Morning America. There was no CBS This Morning. The cable channels were still decades in the future. So if you were watching television in the morning, you were watching Today. You were watching Dave Garraway. And so talk about cultural saturation. He was the only choice for 9 years that he was the host of the Today Show. And then, of course, Good Morning America didn't even come along until 1975. So even well after he was gone from the Today Show, he was still kind of the only game in town. The reason I think he was so influential to it is there was not a guarantee that morning television would succeed. So Dave was brought in the fall of 1951 to help launch this program because they needed the right person. Who does America want to wake up to? We don't really know for sure. And so they threw out a couple of different ideas. Maybe it's somebody who's over-caffeinated. Maybe it's somebody who talks rapidly. Maybe it's a comedian. There was even one concept, preliminary concept for the Today Show that was more like a variety show with singers and dancers and, I don't know, a buffet or something. I mean, it just seemed more like a cruise than a news program, But they threw all that out and they said, well, let's do a news program that also has elements of talk and interview review and introspection, and we get people in the studio to talk about the ideas of our day and our time, authors and people like that. And Dave auditioned for it in a sense that he impressed the people who were putting the show together, and in that personal style, getting them in the same room and convincing them just through his own knowledge and his own behavior, they'd walk out of the room and go, this is the guy. How could you hire anybody else? I mean, who else could tame this three-ring circus at 7 o'clock in the morning that's going to be news, weather, sports, authors, music, traveling sometimes, going to places, fashion shows, cooking, all that stuff. And Dave Garraway had that body of knowledge, which we talked about, that made him effective in that role. He later said he felt that the role was created for him. As soon as he found out about it, before he was ever hired, he said, this is made for me. And it turned out to be true.
But the producers weren't entirely confident in Dave Garraway because they brought in a little bit of a sideshow act in the form of J. Fred Muggs. Tell us about J. Fred Muggs.
That's another one of those that if you meet a person of a certain age, they'll know exactly who you mean, but most people today, that's a forgotten name. J. Fred Muggs was not a newsreader or a cameraman or a producer or a director of any sort. He was a chimpanzee. And he was brought on to Today in March of 1953, in part because by this point the show was 1 year old, it was doing well, it was getting good critical reception, audience numbers were growing, but they weren't growing fast enough for NBC. And so they were looking for a gimmick, for lack of a better word. What can get people to tune into this program? And just by coincidence, J. Fred Muggs and his two human handlers were booked on an episode of the show just to be guests, you know. And in thinking about it, after that guest appearance ended, they thought, well, that went pretty well. What if we bring on this chimp all the time? And they signed him to a contract. They signed the human handlers to a contract. They said, let's see how this goes. And what they discovered was, I can't believe I'm saying this, the chimp kind of made the show appointment viewing for millions of people in this country. And here's what they discovered once NBC started surveying the audience afterward and the ratings started going up. They were trying to figure out what it was, that kids would turn on the Today Show to see the chimp, but mom and dad would stay watching after the kids had gone to school to see the news. Everybody was getting something out of it.
And so what's your entry point into all this? I think it was the Today Show and just finding out about the Today Show, and then that led you down another research path, no?
It did, yeah. I was 17 years old when the Today Show turned 50. And of course, like most Americans my age, I grew up with Today as just a presence. You know, it had just been on as long as I could remember. And so I never thought about it having a defined beginning point. It was like the universe. It's just always been there as far as I know. And I grew up, of course, in the kind of Katie Couric, Bryant Gumbel, Matt Lauer era. And so when Today turned 50, I read an article in TV Guide, and it explained that all these other people had been the hosts of the Today Show long before I was ever thought of. And I was kind of amazed by that. It was, oh, there's a lot more depth here than I thought there was. And I was particularly captivated by Dave Garraway. And so the morning that 50th anniversary show aired in January 2002, I had to go to school, but I had my grandmother tape it for me on VHS, of course. And I got home, rewound the tape, and watched it from the beginning, and I was immediately captivated. He still had that power, even though Dave died in 1982, and so was not, of course, present, but they showed film clips from his era on the show, with the few surviving records. And even through that, he had the power to captivate and to make the world look much more interesting and colorful and thoughtful, because he was a very erudite person. It's something that's really missing in television in general today. He wore glasses, he wore a bow tie, he liked jazz and wore Argyle socks, and he was, you could think of him as the most square person on the face of the earth, but he was very cool in 1952.
Yeah, he was even labeled a hepcat.
Oh, very hepcat. Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you know, when you, in movies and TV shows, when you see a jazz audiences snap at the end of a performance. Dave invented that, by the way, that's in the book, and helped popularize the word hassle. Like, you know, this interview is such a hassle, EJ. You know, Dave helped popularize that. So yeah, I mean, he was such a trendsetter in the 40s and 50s, but here I was watching him in 2002, having no prior knowledge and going, wow, you know, this guy gets it. He still had a power to resonate with an audience. And so I started researching the history of the Today Show a lot more extensively. And in that era, it meant sort of going to these primitive websites. This is 2002, 2003. It was Paleolithic era internet, you know, but discovering as much as I possibly could. Then I started thinking more seriously as I got older about maybe doing a biography and starting to pursue more leads in that direction, working with some archivists at the Library of American Broadcasting at the University of Maryland, where some of Dave's papers went. And then finally, several years ago, making contact with Jody Peeler, the lead author of the book. She's a communications professor in South Carolina, has developed into a very, very dear friend of mine and had the same idea. It's those great minds think alike kind of situation. And it ended up being a very fruitful partnership, and finally bringing his story to life, that to bring us full circle to the beginning of the interview, Dave Garraway, the most famous guy you've never heard of, I couldn't believe that no one had sat down and written a biography. TV stars write memoirs, people write biographies of him all the time. He did not release his autobiography. He compiled notes on it, but never got around to the publication stage when he died. And so those notes kind of languished until Jody and I came along and put them into book form.
And, you know, Dave's story has a very tragic finale. I wondered if you could talk about that event that kind of concludes his own biography.
This is a part that is difficult to talk about because it can seem morbid or lurid, and I think that's how a lot of people think of it, but it really is, it's a tragedy. As we mentioned a little earlier, he had a dependency issue with Dexedrine, and what that does, that's not just an upper, it sort of taxes your system, and he took it for years, and so it wore down his heart, it wore down his body. So through the 1970s, this is after he'd left the Today Show, he was not finding a whole lot of work outside of, a few gigs here and there, and was really struggling. And his depression, which of course never fully left him, and the drug dependency were wearing him down kind of from both ends. He never fully kind of came out of that. It turns out that he had two heart attacks and didn't even know it until it showed up in an EKG at a checkup at the doctor's office. So his heart was beginning to fail on him, and in October 1979, he had to go in for extensive heart surgery. The surgery went well, but he developed complications, and that just hastened his decline. So from October of 79, he was in worse and worse health going through, and his moods were getting more and more dour. He was becoming more withdrawn, and then kind of as a weird quirk, after that 30th anniversary show in January 1982, he sent a thank you note to the producers in New York and said, thank you for having me. It was just great. And now let's look to 1987 and the 35th anniversary. But it was 6 months after that. His wife left for an appointment, and he shot himself in their home in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. And when the housekeeper arrived for work a little after 9 a.m., she found his body. And it's still a bit of a mystery why that happened.
And throughout his career, Garraway was known for holding up his palm and signing off with peace. Mm-hmm. And that gesture is what gives the biography its title. Can you talk about why that gesture and that word was important to him?
He picked it up from a pastor who was on the radio when Dave was in his formative years in radio, 1930s and 40s, and it was a little bit modified. The pastor was a little more fiery, and he'd say something like, peace, it's good for you, But he heard the word peace, and he thought, I like that. He was a man who did believe strongly in peace, not just interpersonal, but international peace. Especially because his tenure overlapped with that of the Cold War, it was something that was on his mind a lot. And so at the end of each broadcast, he'd hold up his hand, as you said, right palm facing forward, which he attributed as a general gesture. Like if you think about, God, to go off in another direction, the pioneer plaques that Carl Sagan attached to the pioneer probes, and they show the man and the woman and the outline of the spacecraft in case any aliens find it. What is the man doing? He's raising his right hand. In our cultures on Earth, it is considered a gesture of goodwill. It shows you're not holding a weapon. It is a friendly gesture. It's not a middle finger. It's not anything that you can't misinterpret. And so Dave picked up on this idea in the 50s, well before Carl Sagan. You raise your right hand as a goodwill gesture and say peace. He did change that after he left the Today Show. He got a few radio jobs, and instead of saying peace at the end of the radio show, he would say courage. But he believed that those concepts were intertwined and they were important to him throughout his career.
Well, Brandon, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. I mean, you didn't have far to walk, but I just really want to thank you so much for coming in and talking about this and just shedding so much light on the life of Dave Garraway.
I appreciate the time and the opportunity, EJ, and I hope people enjoy the book.
And I think we should sign off, peace and courage. That was Spokane Public Radio's own Brandon Hollingsworth discussing Dave Garraway and the book that he co-wrote with Jody Peeler about him called Peace, The Wide, Wide World of Dave Garraway, television's original master communicator. You can find more information about the book and its authors at jodypeeler.com/Dave-Garraway. And you can find the book itself on Amazon or request it from local booksellers like Auntie's. This has been the Thursday Arts Preview, a show that keeps an eye on the past, present, and future of the art scene throughout the Inland Northwest. If you'd like to listen again or catch future episodes as soon as they air, subscribe to the Thursday Arts Preview podcast on major platforms like Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm E.J. Iannelli.
Thursday Arts Preview receives support from Boo Radley's, toys, books, and gifts for the quirky-minded, and Atticus, the coffee shop and gift store for the grown-up lurking within, both on Howard, across from the Carousel, in downtown Spokane.